Hello, I'm your host of VSpeaks Conversation with Heart and Soul, Lisa Burwell. So I'm so excited today to bring you our guest, Robert Davis, visionary and founder of Seaside Florida, a new urbanism community like none other that has basically been the catalyst for a new urbanism movement here, abroad, and everywhere else in between. Welcome, Robert, to the podcast. How are you?
I'm great. How
good,
about you?
Good. Thank you. Well, I've known you, Robert, for 27 years when I moved from Boston to work for you at Seaside for a couple of years when I was the merchant's marketing director. So we go way back. And I have such a fondness and appreciation to you and Seaside and Daryl, your wife, for basically being a catalyst that really changed my life, because when I moved here, I thought I was just going to be on a two-year contract and move back to Boston, and that did not happen. And I'm actually grateful that it turned a corner in my life, that I was able to stay here and love this place so much like you do and did. And tell the audience a little bit about, take me back 40 years when Seaside was founded, because you're celebrating your 40th this year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So you were in Miami prior to moving here, and your grandfather, you inherited 80 acres from your grandfather. And when did you have the vision to basically envision Seaside?
Well, the envisioning process actually took the better part of 5 or 6 years, probably more than that, because I really envisioned it when I was a small child building sandcastles, and it's kind of a continuation of that
process
with my grandfather. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful picture of me, my grandfather, in our sandcastle
to
us that I like to look at. But the envisioning probably started shortly after I met Daryl, and we went to Southern Europe for 6 months. I took a sabbatical. And we bought a Citroën de Chavaux, a tiny little car that
beautiful car
has a peel back top. That's the most important thing about it.
Okay.
It's an open air car, and it forces you to go slowly because it really is lethal at speed. So you take in the scenery, and you are forced to take back roads, not auto routes or autostrade. And that makes you see more.
Uh-huh.
I was kind of reminded of that as I was riding here for this interview on my bicycle, and how much more you see.
Yes.
And how much more you feel when you're on a bicycle than when you're in a car.
Yes. So true. So true. So when you were sort of slowly meandering through Europe, what were you seeing, that it was such a different lifestyle than America, and that you liked it and wanted to bring the principles here?
Not so much that, though, you know, there were wonderful things about the Southern European, Northern Mediterranean lifestyle that we did bring here. But it was more a matter of really studying how these towns had evolved, as I was studying at the same time that I was looking at these towns and thinking about how so many of them had actually started at a crossroads with just people laying stuff out on tables or on blankets and selling and getting together and buying and selling and
gathering
and exchanging information. And that's the birth of the city.
Mm.
And so that was one of the things that I got. I saw a lot of course, monumental public buildings, a huge amount of time, energy, and money that had been invested in making streets and squares really feel like great outdoor rooms. That much I got even in the late 80s as I was looking at this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I saw ways of dealing with the beach that were still evolving in Seaside. You know, beach clubs in the Mediterranean are really wonderful social gathering devices.
Right. So I conjured up in my mind when Daryl would open the fruit stand and vegetables, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the very beginning of Seaside, you had implemented
that type of
gathering.
That was the whole idea
the genesis of
the embryonic very primitive and very simple beginnings of yes. town building. We made our mark.
Right. And so when you did that and you were at the simple beginning, did you ever see and envision what it is today and what you created in the new urbanism town of Seaside?
Yeah, very, very soon thereafter. I mean, in the late 70s, we started doing master planning. And at that point, it was just diagrams and concept drawings, but, you know, a few pretty pictures.
Right.
And it took us a while to get back to the point where we could do traditional vernacular architecture, meaning just what Northwest Florida cottages and houses in a way that wasn't ironic or somehow an expression of our time, of the zeitgeist. We were trying to go back beyond that and just do it straight.
Right.
And it was considered pretty weird at that point because not, you know, we were all imbued with so much irony in the late 20th century, we couldn't think of just doing this straight. Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly from hearing you speak many times, many years ago, that Seaside and new urbanism is basically the antithesis of suburbia and how it was to be nothing like suburbia.
Actually, I'm not sure that's true either.
Okay.
We actually studied in considerable depth during the same period from looking at Southern Europe. We also were going to England and New England and the Northeast and looking at what Robert Stern called the Anglo-American suburb. And
Nantucket and...
No, Nantucket's actually a special thing. It's an old fishing town, mm-hmm, a whaling mm-hmm. town, that turned into a resort because it was so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
That's happened to a lot of towns.
Right.
But this was more the best neighborhoods in America that were built in the 1920s. Were suburbs. They were early suburbs. They accommodated the automobile, but they didn't prostrate themselves in front of the automobile, okay. prostrate.
Right. So then how did you go about, I think you told me just before the interview that there's a person that introduced you to Dwani for the master planning, yeah. the fairy godmother of new urbanism.
Susan Leward was an editor at House Beautiful, and she was doing... one of my Miami townhouse projects for the magazine and scouting other things for future magazines. And she, in her scouting, she discovered this new firm of young kids who had recently graduated from Harvard, Princeton, et cetera. And they said, she told me these are hot young architects. You ought to meet them. So we did. And we started hanging out at Architectonica, which was Bernardo Forbrescia, whose work has become very famous for the Miami Vice images, that big building with the hole in the sky and the diving board.
Right. so that's how you met. Okay. And then you got together and started.
And then it turned out that Liz and Andreas were the partners in that firm that actually had an interest in what we wanted to do. Glamorous as Bernardo and Lorenda were, his wife, they were not interested at all in relearning traditional architecture. They were way beyond that.
Right. Well, how long did that take then? Once you met Andre and his wife, how long did it take to put this master plan on the books?
I think we met Andreas in the late 70s, 77 or 78 probably. And it took several more years. We broke ground in 81, but the master plan was still being done then. We simply had a sketch of it, and we knew where the first street should go. But that was very obvious because we were simply recognizing a crossroad.
Mm-hmm.
The first street and the center of town were both done at crossroads of jeep trails that Seagrovians had carved through the dune and the and 30A.
Wow. And that's the street.
And that's Tupelo Street.
Tupelo Street.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And then
The Seaside Pavilion sits at the top of George's Gorge, which was the other crossroad.
So amazing. So much history. So much history. So over the years now, you celebrating 40 years, you just sort of painted a picture at the beginning. Talk to us about where you are now. When you look at your town and you walk around, do you absolutely marvel at what it has become? Do you think that it is something different than you thought it was going to be? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, I do marvel occasionally. Every now and then I have the presence to be present and say, wow, this is pretty great.
Right, as you should.
Most of the time, I live in the future. It's yes. The curse of being a visionary.
Yes, and you
is
are
you're
that.
Constantly thinking yeah. about how much better it could be.
Right. Yes, you are a visionary.
Not so much that I'm disappointed, but just that,
yes.
wow, think of what we could do with this.
Right. Speaking of that, what are some new things that you're going to be doing this year and sort of getting ready for the 40th?
Well, we're working with Walter Chatham, whom you mm-hmm. met mm-hmm. years ago, to convert the old Perspicacity, now Cabana, into a real cabana.
So
and
awesome.
Add cabanas on the south side and incorporate that beautiful pavilion by Derek Smith and Eric Watson that sits at the top of George's Gorge into the bar for the beach club.
And what will that be like? Is that where you want to have some civic memberships?
Yeah, I'm very much interested in this not just being a place for fun in the sun, but a gathering place for local residents who understand that there's a need to support the civic institutions and the civic spaces that we need as a community if we're going to evolve in a positive way with all this population pressure that is happening now with people right. moving down here. It's an opportunity because we have people moving down here who have a lot of money. I mean, that's
yes, they do.
One of the very interesting things. And some of us are alarmed at the monster houses.
Yes.
I would love to have people with a more New England sensibility about wealth building more yes. modest houses and taking some of their wealth and putting it into the public realm.
Yes.
That's a New England.
Yes, I know.
Kind of
I'm from New England. Yes.
You're from New
yes.
England.
So I completely understand.
Right. So we understand that.
Yes.
And I think it can be done, but it requires some major carrots like membership in the beach club.
Right? Good idea.
Would be one of the coolest places on the planet.
Yes, very. Well, when will that be done or when are you breaking ground?
Well, breaking ground is easy. We're going to try to do that this late fall,
okay.
early winter.
Okay.
When will it be done? Probably when Micah's great-great-grandchildren
oh,
decide
please.
That it's...
Micah is Robert's son, for people who don't know that. So it's not going to take that long, I hope.
Right. So this is true of town building in general. Yep. And, the evolution of a beach club would presumably keep on happening over generations as new fun things to do at the beach reveal themselves.
Right. And then the other is the court, too, that's
the
coming
The court
on.
Is going to be ready for... occupancy by friends and family, we hope, in late April.
That is very exciting.
And then, we'll open it up to the public once we make sure that everything kind of works.
Right, right. And tell the listeners a little bit about that. You had converted the motor courts that were really...
The motor court itself represents a conversion early in its career before it even got a certificate of occupancy from a mini storage compound and parking lot to a motel. Mm-hmm. And its working name was the No-Tell Motel, as you may recall.
I do. I stayed
we
there.
We lost our nerve.
Right. Yeah, I like them.
But we're kind of imbuing that it's now going to be the court because all the motor cars will be parked around the perimeter of it. Mm-hmm. And there will be an interior courtyard which represents Micah's taking this thing over and working with his contemporary, Isaac Stein, who also grew up here, on transforming the interior courtyard from a parking lot to a veritable jungle of palms and palmettos and oaks.
An oasis.
What's that?
An oasis.
An oasis.
Yeah, I don't know. Can't wait to see that. It looks like a beautiful project. And then Black Bear.
And the Black Bear is moving there. So we will have a cafe, wine bar, et cetera, that we think will do extremely well.
Yes, that's going to be amazing. I cannot wait to see that. So I remember years ago, hopefully this is a correct memory that I have, when I would listen to you talk, that you had first envisioned that the town of Seaside would maybe have, like, for lack of a more elegant way of saying it, the right side of the tracks and the wrong side of the tracks, where you would have some people that were the butcher that were living in town and, you know, the merchants and all that. And then organically, the sale of the homes and the prices kept escalating, and that sort of negated that that could be something that you had maybe seen in the town.
Well, Walter Chatham and I have often talked about Seaside needing a dark side.
Okay.
And for a while, it was going to be our maintenance area, where we actually did build a kind of bunkhouse for summer interns to live in, as well as use as a workshop. They'd simply roll up their sleeping bags and then take out the sawhorses and start sawing and stuff.
Right.
And that worked for a while. But all these things just got gentrified. Forest Street was going to be one of these places. And then Ruskin Place was supposed to be just workshops with people making stuff, including working on old cars and things in the on the ground floor. And then if they were making furniture or crafts, they would push them out into the sidewalk and hawk them to people going to the chapel on the Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I lived there 27 years ago in Ruskin Place on the first floor there. And it was that with the coffee shop when it was there. Yeah. And then the artisans, and it really felt good. Not that it doesn't feel good now, but it really...
Well, it feels great. But that's an example of scarcity in the real estate business creating price rises that are pretty amazing. And Ruskin Place, as it turned out, was the most desirable neighborhood in Seaside if you want to live there long term, because the houses are big. You have parking under the house in the back. It has a service alley. It has a beautiful front yard.
Yes, it does.
Really beautiful.
Ruskin Place is beautiful.
I mean, it was modeled after Belgravia and Mayfair in London.
Yes, it's beautiful.
Which are the most desirable residential neighborhoods on the planet. And because of gentrification, Russian oligarchs and Mideast oil barons, these places cost just zillions of pounds.
Okay.
And just nuts.
Yeah. Well, I think we're getting there.
We're approaching it.
Yeah, we are approaching it.
So I do think that we have an opportunity, if we can create enough consciousness about the cultural activities that actually we already have here, like the Rep Theater.
Right. Seaside Institute.
And
even the chapel being here is
The chapel's totally a wonderful
gathering
institution.
Institution. Yeah.
So, you know, it's another one of these gathering places. I'm hopeful that, you know, my next project for the chapel is a church camp or some, you know, Bible camp that would recruit people, congregations from Atlanta, Birmingham, et cetera, and occupy Seaside during spring break with kids who have something to occupy their time besides gathering on the beach and sneaking
on the dark
drinks
side
and dope and whatever. What's that? I mean, it's part of their growing thing, but we really do need to, you know, absorb all this energy that young teens have in some productive ways. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, we want to do theater camp and art camp and music camp and things of that sort.
Right. So years and years ago, I keep kind of going back and forth from the beginning until where we are present day right now. But I remember having an office above Modica Market and looking out the window and seeing you walking with a gentleman with like a flock of human seagulls behind them in a perfect V. And I commented to somebody in the office and I said, who is that walking with Robert? And why are all those people walking behind them like that? And they said, oh, that's Michael Eisner from Disney. He's here like getting some tips from Robert about how to do something down in Disney. Tell us a little bit about that and all the different people who have come to you looking for consultation and guidance and just looking at what you did.
Well, Michael had actually been preceded numerous times by the Disney development team. Peter Rummel and his crew would fly up on the Mickey jet. I'd meet them in the morning and we would wander around Seaside and they'd take notes and photographs and go back to Orlando and plan Celebration. As the planning cohered, Robert Stern, who was involved with the planning, along with Jack Robertson, both of whom were Seaside Prize winners and mentors to Andreas, Liz, me, etc. These guys, Robert was on Michael's board. So because he was on the Disney board, he had the right to suggest to Michael Eisner that he visit the source of all these ideas that were going into Celebration and see Seaside and see how important it was for these kind of fine-tuned, fine-grained details to be done right, and how important it was actually to get the scale right. Mm-hmm. And it was a fascinating thing. Michael was like a kid in a candy store. He wanted to start building Seasides everywhere, and he thought, well, we could just buy Cheyenne, Wyoming, or Cody, or and create resorts out of it.
Right.
Because you know, a small town is a perfect model for a resort.
Yes.
Peter was walking around with him and saying, well, yes, Modica Market's fabulous. This is, you know, we should have something like this. But, of course, it has to be 10 times the size to get the grocery store chain interested in occupying it because, it, you know, grocery stores have to be 50,000 square feet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The scale. Norm is. Yeah. And in fact, they've been shrinking in cities, but that's been happening since the Eisner visitation.
Yes. Very interesting.
So anyway, all these things, it was like Peter's job. He wasn't even supposed to be on this trip because Robert was trying to get Michael out of Peter's clutches at least for a day to, you know, get it right and then go back and insist that Peter pay more attention to Charleston.
Right. Wow, that's so fascinating. And then
they had gone to Charleston, Savannah, et cetera.
Okay.
So they really,
they did
it wasn't
homework.
Just Seaside.
Right.
They did much the same thing, but much more quickly that Daryl and I and Liz and Andreas had done in our travels by land yacht throughout the South, looking at these old places.
Mm-hmm. So then there's a rumor. I actually always thought Prince Charles had come here to consult with you, but
unless he sneaked in incognito.
I'm sure you would have remembered.
No, Prince Charles, a lot of people who worked with Prince Charles have been to Seaside, and the His Royal Highness organized a TV series called A Vision of Britain that featured Seaside. And so he had a film crew from BBC. They were shooting 35 millimeter. This shows you how long ago it was.
All right.
Come here. And there's a lovely film that you can buy or rent or download, I'm sure.
But they were taking, you know, your foundational principles down for what they were going to continue doing there.
And then they, you know, published this in a book called A Vision of Britain. It's probably in the Sundog.
Yes.
And then the next move that Prince of Wales did was to build his own version, but much bigger and much more complex and more interesting as a true multi-use mixed income
town,
live work town. They have factories at the edge of the town that people can walk to, just like the good old days.
Right. The good old days were very good.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the problems with walking to the factory is if it was a slaughterhouse or a steel mill, you were getting poisoned because your house was within walking distance of it. Wow. And that's why we created zoning. But of course, now a place that makes chocolates or a bakery, which is, you know, the kind of, or the workshop that makes wooden furniture, is not emitting noxious fumes. It's actually pretty nice.
That is very interesting. So, Robert, let's talk about some of the really, really cool things that happen in the town that were not just building the town, but were the people that came to the town like 27 years ago when Bud and Ally's would host, as they still do now, the wine dinners for the Seaside Red and White Wine Festival. And then Robert Mondavi of Mondavi Wines is here with his wife for an evening that I'll never forget. How did you get Robert Mondavi to come here?
I can't remember how I met Robert Mondavi, but I think it was probably through Lydia Bastianich, who was also here.
Yes, at the same time.
At the same weekend. Mm-hmm. This was one of our first or second wine fest, and we had no idea how to promote this. So we had a handful of people show up to a vertical tasting of Bob's private reserve cabs going back a generation. I mean, it was just amazingly great wines. And, you know, you paid some pittance to do this, and we only had like a dozen people doing this.
Yeah. But the dinner had a lot of people.
I didn't spit them out either. I just enjoyed them.
The dinner was sold out.
The dinner was fantastic.
That was amazing.
Well, Lydia is one of the great restaurateurs of the world.
Yes.
She, of course, had her own cooking show after participating in Julia Child's cooking show.
Yes.
I had met her because she, I don't know how I met her, but I know that she had fed the members of the jury who gave me the Rome Prize. So I credit her for being kind of the fairy godmother of one of my peak experiences, which was a fellowship at the American Academy.
That's very impressive. I mean, just to think about like all the different people that have that recognized that this was such a special place before so many others did, I think that was the charm of living here back then and being part of Seaside, because it was like a movie.
It was kind of interesting in that it really was a well-kept secret for quite a while, but those who knew, knew. And
yes.
It was like
the spot. Not that it's
pretty
not
cool
the spot,
to see these people showing up.
Pretty cool. And speaking of movies, so let's take it back 24 years ago when The Truman Show came into town and took over the town and made a movie.
Right. And saved us from imminent bankruptcy, by the way. This was right after Hurricane Opal. And, of course, the business interruption insurance, which we thought we had, really doesn't pay you anything.
Right.
So we were scrambling.
Right. That was such a save.
All of a sudden, this miracle, the clouds parted. Yeah. Peter and Wendy Weir showed up and said, we want to make a movie here.
Yes, that was amazing.
And we pretended to be hard to get, so we demanded a huge location fee.
Yes, good for you.
Which we used to build the school. This
right,
was Darryl's
I know.
Idea.
I remember, the money went to go to the school.
It took greed off the table so we could be even more greedy than we would have been if we'd been pocketing the money.
Well, Hollywood has the bucks, right? And definitely. So what was that like for you, though? When I thought it was amazing when, like in one day, maybe a half a day, when the movie crew would just take a facade off one of the places in Ruskin Place and then put something completely up. Were you amazed at like how fast that crew could do that?
Oh, it was fantastic.
Why don't movie crews like run the world and like make towns then? How do they do it so fast?
Well, what you have to realize is that these things are designed to fall apart in
2 months.
Oh, they could last 4 months, maybe six if you keep repainting them, which they do.
Right.
But they are very much stage sets. But
it was remarkable.
You know, we didn't know that because we asked them to leave one of the buildings and we turned it into an arcade with pinball machines to keep the kids occupied that year.
And then
summer.
It fell apart.
Well, they were actually in danger of getting electrocuted because whenever it rained,
Not funny.
Not funny. We had to kick them out and tear the building down pretty quickly.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord. So what was it like meeting some? Did you meet Jim Carrey and what did you think of him? Yeah.
Well, Carrey was an interesting figure, but he was much more standoffish than Peter and Wendy and Laura Linney and the others. They actually all lived in Seaside.
Yes.
Carrey had to get himself a big beach house off down
property.
The road.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Off property and be delivered by a chauffeured limo to Seaside. And, you know, he was at that point in his life where he thought that that kind of noblesse was obligatory.
Required. Yes. Yes. Well, that was that was one more fascinating story.
But the Laura taught at the school and really got involved in the, and everybody showed up after the shoot was over for the day. They showed up at the wine bar, which never had a season like that. It was amazing. They would keep that place open till 3 a.m.
Yeah, fascinating. And then right around, I think a year before that, no, actually several years later, then Louis Sakoggis, the movie director who directed and filmed The Cove about the atrocities that were happening in Japan with killing dolphin. And I remember viewing that film. We covered it in the magazine as well, but we were sitting there in, you know, the Seaside Rep, and there were has a capacity of 100 people. And I remember watching the movie and then listening to the presentation after and just pinching myself, wondering, how does this happen in this small town to have so many amazing things happen here? And there's only 100 people in here that can experience it. I mean, it's very, very special. And then he went on to win the Oscar shortly after that. I think it was about a month later. He won the Oscar for that, too. I found him fascinating, and I found the documentary fascinating, too. But these are just some snippets of things that have happened at Seaside over time, because there are so many more that I can't even really remember exactly right now, but they were commonplace. You know, when we had Michael McDonald here for the concerts and Kim Carnes, and you just did these pickup concerts and everything that we would do, and all famous acts from New Orleans and all that we had here were just like incredible moments in time that we were really lucky and blessed to have. I miss those days myself because it seemed all simpler than it is now and less congested. But it was a moment in time that I'm glad that I got to experience.
Yeah, in an odd way, even though we were much less well-known, it was easier to get these stars to show up because it was such a cool place to go.
Yeah, so amazing.
But I think we can revive that.
I don't think that's lost or anything. I'm just thinking, like, when you look back on how few people lived here at the time, so there wasn't the density or the mass to, like, have these people want to hang out here. But they did because our area has a very entrepreneurial, bohemian, artsy spirit and vibe, which you had instilled in Seaside when you came here. And, you know, Grayton Beach has it. And, you know, if you're a pioneer or you're a visionary, I'm a visionary and I'm an entrepreneur, it's the right place to have been planted when you have visions beyond, you know, punching a clock from 9 to 5 or just whatever someone's going to be doing. If you wanted to do something really great, this was the place to do it, and it still is, but it is amazing how many people of notoriety, artistry, intelligence, and all that have come to this little place on the beach that has been amazing. And if you didn't create a sandcastle when you were a boy that turned into a beautiful new urbanism town, you know, what would this place be? I mean, when you really think about placemaking, you know, it's a word, placemaking, that architects use and marketeers use. But when you really think of it with the genuine spirit that you did it, it was, I don't even know the word. It was, so important and vital to what we ended up turning into here. Because if there wasn't the placemaking that you made in this new urbanism community, what would be here? And then the civic mindedness that we have.
I mean, the alternate history is always kind of interesting, but impossible to
correctly think about. But then you also, so many things in your visionary site that you have 30 years ago, you formed the Conservation Commission, where I'll let you tell your story 30 years ago, what you saw happening and what you did and how you see that evolving now.
Well, the Conservation Development Plan grew out of the state's purchase of 21,000 acres of land from the FDIC, which had foreclosed on a savings and loan back in the early 90s after the deregulation essentially decimated that industry. So it was a great opportunity. The county commissioners were freaked out that almost half of the land mass in the south part of the county, which was their piggy bank, was being taken off the tax rolls. I'm sure they had envisioned, you know, every single one of those acres covered with several houses. And they had several months while they were meeting with state agency officials to decide which of this land actually needed to be in conservation and which parcels might go back onto the tax rolls and back into development. Mm-hmm. So that was going nowhere. I was in Tallahassee every couple of weeks and would go to these meetings. And I was supposed to be in the Elms Commission, which was rewriting the land use laws, but I found that incredibly boring. Mm-hmm. So I went to watch the fights instead. It was really entertaining.
So, but you did foresee back then that our area was going to need to have a paradigm shift from vacation rentals to
residential. That was part of what we came out with in the report 2 years later. But it took some time to convince both the county and the state that we should step back and do a real plan, do an environmental assessment to begin with, because nobody had enough information to say which acreage needed to be conserved. Mm-hmm. So we managed miraculously to get about $1 million from the state to do this. Mm-hmm. We hired some great consultants and had a pretty good board of trustees that the county appointed half of, and the governor appointed the other half of. I was a governor's appointee, of course. I don't think the county would have appointed me. But we came up with a pretty good plan. And one of it had several things that have yet to be implemented. One was a new town north of 331, or west of 331 and north of 98 that would have a mix of workforce housing, market rate housing, and schools, and maybe a university campus. And I think this is still possible. It got beaten down by the NIMBYs, mm-hmm. who put on their green environmental cloaks and made sure that the state and the county did not designate this for development. Mm. Instead, they designated it to become a series of parking lots with large boxes on them, the county annex, the mm-hmm. school, the library, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it can become a town. It can replan this to make it a place that people would want to live, which is going to be essential, because the other part of the plan was we cannot continue to have the kind of traffic made up of single-occupant automobiles that will plague this place once it becomes very popular. And its popularity and financial success were predicted by Chris Leinberger, our economic development consultant, who said this place has the risk of becoming, in Yogi Berra's wonderful words, a place nobody goes to anymore because there are too many people, mm-hmm. because it will lose its cachet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is in danger of doing that, of course, right. But it also has the potential, if we can deal with the mobility issues, of becoming one of the coolest places on the planet.
Well, yes, it's unsustainable to continue on like we're going. So what can we do?
Well, as you know, maybe some of your listeners know, we've been working with the Seaside Institute and the 30A Alliance for some years on a mobility plan for the county that will allow commuters, people who work here in South Walton and live in North Walton, to ride to work instead of drive to work. Mm-hmm. That's already happening, but it's a very flawed design and doesn't get people to their workplaces yet. Mm-hmm. It will. Mm-hmm. The next move is to have a shuttle running up and down 30A in a dedicated lane through the congested parts like Watercolor, Seaside, Seagrove, and then it can share the lanes with the other vehicles if we can incentivize people to get out of the cars and SUVs and use these little transit vehicles or bicycles or golf carts or other things that will take up a lot less space and right. That we can accommodate in these dedicated lines.
Well, we need you. We need you to keep doing the thinking and championing the problem because more people need to talk about it. It needs to be discussed all the time because people, aren't talking. To be civic-minded, it's literally a mindset, and it's hard to be civic-minded when, you just want and want for yourself, and you have to understand that that will eventually hurt you and your own property. If you can educate people that their property would be in much better shape and for a longer time if there was a more responsible approach to the civicness of what you're doing in a town and where you live, it's very important. I know that so many people are going to be fascinated by this interview because you're such a smart, intelligent visionary. But I do think that I'm going to have a surprise here where maybe a lot of people don't know what I'm about to say next. And that is that in addition to all of your many talents and interests, you are also a race car driver, which I think is super cool.
Well, primarily a vintage race car driver, which is a kind of Walter Mitty pursuit.
Okay. But it still goes fast, right?
Driving relatively slow cars fast.
Okay. How fast?
I just sold my fastest car, Lotus 23, because it was...
Too fast?
I was beginning to realize that my reflexes weren't as fast enough for this car, but they're just fine for a Lotus 7 and...
Well, how fast did that car go that you just sold, your Lotus? How fast?
When it was re-geared for... the track in Austin, the Formula One track, it was going about 145, which is fast enough. It wasn't so much that mm-hmm. as everything happened quicker, and it had a lot more cornering power. And so you have to be sliding these cars around, these old cars. They don't grip right. the way modern cars
right,
did.
Right.
And sliding it at these alarmingly high speeds was getting to be more and more thrilling.
Oh, okay. Too fun, so you had to stop.
What's that?
Too fun, so you had to stop.
Yeah, I had to stop before I killed myself. But I think it's a wonderful hobby because it requires enormous concentration. It's a form of meditation.
Really? That's so interesting. So when did you start race car driving?
I started it about 15 years ago when I was given a co-pilot's seat in a car that Mark Gessler, who was a Seaside homeowner at the time, was entering one of these rallies. And then we did the Mille Miglia together. We did the Colorado Grand, the Mille Miglia, and I was sold.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mark ended up selling me a car, which turned out to be a fabulous tour car and a fun race car in its way. It's the slowest car by far, but it's really easy to hang the tail out and entertain the people in the grandstands because it will get into any of these big events like Monterey Historics or Mille Miglia.
So interesting. Does Daryl mind you doing that?
No.
Does she get worried?
Now and then she's worried. I've crashed occasionally and she gets a little upset.
Just a little. Okay.
But I haven't killed myself yet.
Well, that's good. That is really good. Oh, wow. That's going to be really interesting.
So it's one of the interesting things that very few people know is that New Urbanism was founded by a group of motorheads. At least all the guys were. They all had
really
fast
sports
cars.
So they go hands
cars.
In hand, huh? Yeah, you're living
right.
on the edge.
It's a movement, in our view, to save the last remaining curving, beautiful scenic roads for sports cars from suburban sprawl.
Love it. That's good. That's good. All right. Well, in our remaining 5 minutes, Robert, let's talk about everything that we didn't talk about yet. What were some absolute highlights in your journey with Seaside, and then a low light or two? Just, you know, because everything's not awesome in life.
What were some of the low points?
The low and the high points, right. the highest of high, because in on a journey, you're going to have both, you know, like regarding Seaside, the town and the journey that you've gone through, which has been immense.
Well, in some ways, the past year has been one of the high points for me because, COVID-19 has forced us all to slow down and to spend more time with a very small number of people.
I agree.
And Seaside's been a wonderful place to do this.
Yes. It's like kind of like the old days.
What's that?
Kind of like the old days. That's what I feel too.
Particularly the first few months when we completely shut the place down, there were a handful of homeowners who moved here from Atlanta, Memphis, Dallas, et cetera. And we would just see each other on the streets and have conversations from picket fence to front porch. And it was really like the old days. You know?
Very much. What's a low light? Something that was like really hard that you had to like forge through with the town.
I think being sued by the town council was really one of those low points.
That would be low.
It was very low.
That would be a low point.
A low blower, if
yes,
you will. But it was really unfortunate that the almost inevitable contentiousness that homeowner associations and condo associations devolve into hit at a point when it did. But it probably was going to happen at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And this was over a proposal to redevelop the motor court site and a proposal to recycle a half dozen Katrina cottages and turn them into student housing. So we're being accused of creating a slum and violating our code. Well, the proposal for the motor court never happened. And the Katrina cottages seemed like a good idea, and it was kind of nice having them, but they made no sense. And at the end, so we've sold them on to become affordable housing.
Right.
But it's odd. The lawsuit continues because it has a life of its own, kind of like Bleak House, Jarndyce and Jarndyce. At the end of the day, the lawyers make some money.
Yeah, lawyers make money. They do. Well, I mean, the very nature of associations, just, you know, a group of people, that is almost an impossibility to have unity in such an environment. That's just...
Well, I don't know that there is a solution, and I haven't figured it out, but I've urged future developers, like the group from Auburn who came here last week, to really focus on governance and imagine what it's going to be like as you turn over the common areas, the properties, the street squares, et cetera, to the homeowners.
Yes.
You know, what is it going to be like then?
Right.
And to read the Federalist Papers, because our founding fathers were very smart and very cynical about human nature. They knew that people—
That it was what it was, right? It was
people
what it is.
Were bound to fall into divisiveness and party politics that would be ugly.
Yes. Wow. Well, we just have 1 minute left. And I just want to thank you so very much for everything that you've done for all of us that live here, what you created and what that birthed into the scenic 30A corridor and beyond has been something, nothing short of, just like a paradise, basically, what you created. And for all of our livelihood and our ability to be in such a great place, I thank you very much. And I wish you continued health, success, and prosperity.
Well, thanks.